Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your fast food battle royale of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Why you gotta fight with me at Cheesecake? You know I love to go there. Say I'm acting light-skinned. I can't take you nowhere. This a place for families that drive Camrys and go to Disney. They don't need to know all of our business. You wildin', you super childish. You go to CVS for Kotex and my Bugatti. I took the key and tried to hide it so you can't drive it and put on mileage. Then you find it, awkward silence.
Mama, 2016 has been a disruptive year in the pop music ecosystem, and last week on Popcast, we talked about some high points, about our favorite albums of 2016 and moments and artists that we loved. This week on Popcast, I've got the crew back together to talk a little bit about trends of the year, news themes, and bigger picture ideas about what motivated pop music this year and what will continue to shape it in years beyond. I've got chief pop music critic John Pareles.
Hey there.
Pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli.
I'm here too.
You will not be erased.
Thank you.
And we started off with Child's Play, track number 14. That's 1-4 on Drake's Views.
14 of 20.
Yes. Now, we could have gone deeper in, but we all love that song. The reason we picked a Drake deep album cut, or deep in the album cut of Views, is we want to start off by talking about streaming. This has been a huge year for the streaming ecosystem in terms of its influence in how artists are getting paid, where they are finding their sponsorship money, or de facto sponsorship money, also kind of what the music sounds like. You can say that there is a streaming aesthetic that is beginning to develop. Drake, whether he's knowing it or not, is at the vanguard of this, and The Weeknd as well. Joe, do you want to start off by talking a little bit about some of the business things that have been happening in streaming this year and how they have shaped how artists make money?
What we saw with Drake at the beginning of the year is something we saw also with Rihanna, also with Beyonce, also with Kanye West. Mm-hmm. And that is this idea of streaming exclusivity windows for albums. So with all of the artists that I just mentioned, the album was released in partnership with one streaming service. Drake is with Apple Music, Kanye, Rihanna, Beyonce, to a lesser extent with Tidal, Jay-Z's streaming service. In a lot of ways, these services have sort of stepped in where major labels have stepped out.
Yes. So where major labels have stepped out, they don't think that there's this sort of like ideological thing that's happening. Because I think a lot of major labels are still like, nah, you need us.
Sure.
And I think a lot of famous people are like, actually, but actually.
Frank Ocean,
hi,
case in point.
Mr. Ocean, who said, I forget if this is in the piece that I wrote, but it's something to the effect of like, I'm very good at assessing the values of relationships, and I assess that one at its value.
what the major labels used to be good at and necessary for was getting your album to the consumer. So you finish it, you turn it in, they send it to the plant. Maybe it leaks on the internet, maybe it doesn't. The plant sends it to the
Best Buy. Shouts to that guy in North Carolina who really did work in the early 2000s.
All the big albums.
I see you, man. I see you.
It was the label's job, essentially, and the distributors to get the product on the shelves, right? They needed it in Best Buy on, it used to be Tuesday, mm-hmm. now it's Friday, when albums come out.
And into ears also.
And into ears.
Yep.
Now that the physical album is an afterthought, some of these albums that I named didn't even come out physically this year at all.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen Views in the wild. I've never held Views in my hand.
Pablo
didn't come out. Views, there is a physical, but you know, it's
where is it?
Feel
free to mail us copies. Sure. If anyone who's listening, feel free to send us physical copies of Views.
People are hearing albums for the first time online at midnight when it comes out. Mm-hmm. It's just all right there to stream. And so the services have sought to lure subscribers by saying, this is the first and only, for a period of time, mm-hmm. place that you're going to hear an album from your favorite artist. So these artists with gigantic fan bases have in some ways limited their audience by saying, it's only going to be on Apple for the first 7 days. The reason they
exclude piracy.
Sure. The reason they do that is they're striking what are essentially marketing deals.
Yeah.
So in the case of Drake and Apple Music, you have a partnership that is so wide-ranging. Drake premieres all of his songs on his Beats One Apple Music radio show,
OVO
Sound Radio. Then it's available in the iTunes store. Then the album is on Apple Music. His tour is sponsored by Apple Music. His music videos premiere on Apple Music.
He's lifting weights to Taylor Swift records.
There you go. It's a
closed ecosystem.
Yes, it's a closed ecosystem. And maybe, you know, where we thought about 360 deals 10 years ago, mm-hmm. now what we're seeing are streaming exclusives. Now,
that was the sort of dark secret about 360 deals was 360 deals were obviously better for the record label than they were for the music.
Because they're making money off the tour, on the
merchandising. Right. And so what it did is sort of removed power from the artists and basically said, you've got to throw in your lot entirely with this major label. And that means you have to give up some percentage of all this stuff that you ordinarily wouldn't give up your percentage of in hopes that the major label will get you to the ears. Streaming services come along and say, yeah, screw all that. We'll get you to the ears and you can keep all that other money. I mean, look, we don't know the nature of Drake's deal with Apple. I don't know if Apple's getting like $3 royalty on every OVO polo shirt. Like, probably not.
Probably not.
Right.
Now, obviously, there's a counterpoint to all of this, and her name is Adele. And she not only is not even streaming her album because mm-hmm. she knows that her fans are going to go to Walmart or wherever it is and buy the CD. But she's not aligning with any one service because she's simply too big and it would be ridiculous for her to limit her audience mm-hmm. in any way. You see that a little bit with Beyonce too. She's, you know, she throws the Lemonade film on Tidal, but
it's not on Spotify.
The album. Right.
Not
but you're
Spotify.
Still going to be able to download it on iTunes.
Yes.
So she's not going to completely write herself into a corner. Tidal, of course, their subscriber base is much smaller than a Spotify or even an Apple Music. Now, when you want to talk about just how big streaming got this year, mm-hmm. I think you can see it most clearly. Yes, the Views numbers are huge. You know, Drake had 1 week totals in the United States of 245 million streams on songs from Views.
Mm-hmm. In a week. In that
divided by how
week.
Many cuts?
That's 20.
20 songs.
So that's 100. I'm sorry. That's 10
let's
to 12
not, million. Let's not do the math here. This is
10
not
to 12 million. It's 10 to 12
yes.
million a song.
Yes. And I believe that that was not the first week because, again, it's only available on Apple Music the first week, but when it went wide.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. then the numbers shoot back up. But just behind him, you know, you have The Weeknd, who in the first week of his new album, Starboy, did 175 million streams in the United States for Starboy across streaming services. Mm-hmm. Now, compare that to the album he released barely a year
and
before
five months,
that,
yeah.
Beauty Behind the Madness. That album actually sold more copies first mm-hmm. week, but it did less than a third of the amount of streams.
In its first week.
In its first week.
Right, and that had hits on it.
And that
had major, major hits.
Two number one hits on it. So you're looking at the same artist making similar music for similar people, and yet the numbers of streams that he's getting in a week are just through the roof compared to where we were at this point in 2015.
Do we know if it's cannibalizing the sales?
Like actual, like hard well, I don't download sales? Yeah.
Well, iTunes sales.
Yes. The downloads down, traditional album sales down, streaming beyond up. Just that is the way that people are consuming, especially pop music at this point. Now, you talk rock, you talk country, you're going to have a different scenario. Right. This is
Adele albums.
Adele album, different scenario. This is mainly you're seeing it in, you know, top 40 pop, EDM, rap, and R&B.
Let's talk a little bit about the aesthetics, because I think what's starting to happen, and you hear this if you say you listen to like a Spotify, you know, New Music Friday or Discover playlist, there's increasingly a kind of common aesthetic that's starting to emerge. It's like flickers in terms of pop music. There's like flickers of dance music production. They're sort of like muted, digitally manipulated vocals. The tempos are like a little bit hot, but not too hot.
A nod to global pop, maybe,
yeah,
in some way.
Yeah, just like a little hint. Nod to R&B, but not actually going in on R&B. There's this sort of common thing that's happening that a lot of artists who are sub Drake and Weeknd are starting to coalesce around. But it's interesting. I mean, JP, you think about the Drake and Weeknd albums as sort of building a streaming aesthetic. And that's actually something that, you know, we say 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you maybe would look at a genre and say, well, this is the album aesthetic of rock in 1996 or the album aesthetic of rap in 2003. And now we're just like, well, it's the playlist aesthetic of pop in 2016.
It's a different way of approaching music if you don't have to commit. It's like I'm not even plunking down 99 cents to have this song. It's like I can try it out. So you can stream through that whole Drake album and then decide, you know, I like track 6 and skip the rest of it and put track 6 in your playlist and keep it forever. I mean, when you had to put cash on the barrelhead and take that album home back in the vinyl days, or even when you were supposed to buy downloads and were pretending not to pirate, there was a sense of commitment. And now it's like, you couldn't, from music. Yeah,
right, but you couldn't return track 7, you know? Like, that was the thing about you buy an album, like, you couldn't return track 7. And that created, I think, a disincentive for artists sometimes when they would just be like, well, we're just going to throw this on there. We don't know if it's going to work or we don't know if it's not going to work. There's something more ruthless that's kind of happening with streaming I think things are, I don't want to say regressing to the mean, but The Weeknd knows what The Weeknd does, in quotation, and Drake knows what Drake does, in quotation marks.
And the other thing that those albums have in common is that they're very long. The Weeknd album is 18 tracks. The Drake album is 20 tracks.
That's a lot of
There's
streams.
Post Malone album that came out today is also
like
18 or 20 songs.
Tracks on that
and this makes sense, right? Because it's like The Weeknd knows and Drake knows that he can put all the different things that he does well there, and the people who like sorts of things are going to find the songs that they want. And just it makes sense mathematically. I mean, you have more of a chance of having a streaming smash if you put out 20 songs and just see which one gets listened to the most. You know, it's sort of a
very different
kitchen sink approach.
It's a very different kind of bloat. And then what's interesting is I feel like this bloat is only going to get worse because you see what Drake is about to do. Drake is about to release something that is not an album, quote unquote.
Or a mixtape.
It's a playlist. Now, whether that's a new thing that's going to happen, whether Billboard's going to recognize it, that's all sort of TBD. But Drake is basically being like, not only did I invent or help to invent the aesthetic of streaming, I also am now just going to be a person who is designed for that ecosystem. I'm not even going to trip off of what the vinyl of this looks like, off of what the CD package looks like.
And part of it is semantic. You know, it's the same thing we saw with If You're Reading This It's Too Late. Is it an album? Is it a mixtape? Now rappers are selling their mixtapes as their albums. MC4, French Montana, you know, is that an album? Is it a mixtape? Sort of sounds somewhere in between.
I don't know. My jaw keeps locking. It's tough to say.
But it doesn't even matter. And that's the bottom line is because people are going to find the songs that they want to listen to.
The things that we used to obsess about, you know, a generation ago, is it an album, is it a mixtape, is it this genre, is it that genre? And as fragments of information make their way around the digital ecosystem without kind of metadata, it doesn't actually matter from whence it comes. As long as I can find it in the sort of big thing, it doesn't actually matter what the context in which it arises.
And to not make this too much labels are dead, let's talk a little bit about the major labels catching up to this, right? We saw a really interesting
thing that Epic Records
did this year, which is they made a playlist for Spotify. They called it a compilation album. They basically took
Epic
their
AF.
Songs. Epic AF. And then I think there's also Epic Lit now. Def Jam recently
followed and did one.
Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're taking their songs that are most popular on streaming services but that don't belong to an album. So French Montana, Lockjaw is a good example. This song comes out. It's not attached to project immediately. Maybe it's a long lead single for his next album. Maybe
it was on a mixtape. It'd be hard to watch a cat when the band keep dropping. Got to be at home and so my pants keep. It'd be hard to understand become a jaw key lock. And I ain't even trying to talk cause my jaw keep locking. She ain't trying to be a freak but them bands keep popping. Still caught up in the streets and the feds still knocking. It'd be hard to understand me, my jaw keep locking. It'd be hard to understand become a jaw key lock. Bite down, bite down. It'd be hard to understand become a jaw key lock. Bite down.
It wasn't on a commercial, a traditional commercial release.
No, not initially.
So what they did was they took it and they put it on basically what's essentially a Spotify playlist, and they populated the rest of that playlist half with songs that are already popular on Spotify and half with songs that they from up and coming artists that they want to be popular.
And it's basically like the it's the digital era equivalent of the Now That's What I Call Whatever series, which has 15 big hits and 5 maybes.
And these are the difference also being that these are all owned by the same label. So it's a promotional tactic aimed at streaming audiences, and it was frankly a pretty smart idea.
And they got on the charts,
and it charted.
It's not on the chart anymore, I don't think.
I think it's still? They're hanging around.
Is there been a sort of official statement from Billboard as far as how they're going to treat kind of playlists that persistently mutate?
You know, I think they're all still
because like
it out.
if that's the metric, then Spotify's Rap Caviar
should be
probably
the
number one album country album in the country.
Yes, every week.
Yeah.
For the rest of time.
Yeah, forever. Like
No, I think the way that the charts
Until
are
Post Malone
handling
swallows
streaming,
rap whole.
People are all still trying to figure it out as it goes. And what we see is, you know, albums that hit number one but sell fewer copies because streams count as album sales.
Yep.
1,500 streams counts as one album sale. And track downloads also can eventually count as an album sale. And that applies even if one person is just listening to one song over and over and over again.
And I got to say, this is the old music business ghost coming back, because it's all about bragging rights. However you can get that number one album on some chart,
right?
Somebody's ego is involved in that.
And what's interesting,
so they keep trying to game the system to get the number one.
And weirdly, like, I feel like there's been some reverse gaming. Like, didn't Bon Jovi have a number one album this year, and it was like basically off of album sales?
Yes, but there was also a trick there, because the album came with tickets to the tour.
Damn, B.
Everyone's just trying to get by. I know is not for sale. I said each stone and I hammered each nail. These houses is not for sale. When memories live and my dreams don't fail. These houses is not for sale. Coming home. I'm coming home. From a spike into the ground and I stay.
A thing that we talked about a little bit on last week's podcast is there were a tremendous number of albums this year by high-profile performers who really invested in the opposite of what we're talking about, in the album as a standalone, coherent narrative, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Drake and Weeknd are actually examples of the other thing, which is they are album-length versions of singles artists, but they are famous enough to sell, quote-unquote, sell albums.
Well,
let's look at it the other way.
Those are shuffle albums.
Right.
And we're talking about old-fashioned narrative albums.
And why, I feel like part of the reason this had a comeback is I think there's a certain category of artist, whether it's a Bon Iver or a Beyonce or whatnot, who understand that they don't want to play in that ecosystem. They understand that they have to be present in those places, but they don't want to be listened to in the same way. JP, talk to me a little bit about why this is starting to happen in this moment. Like, in a moment when The Weeknd has 2 million streams in a week, why is Bon Iver or Beyonce or Frank
showing
Ocean
up in the top 10?
Yeah, and show, making a coherent standalone album and also succeeding with it.
Well, I think it's partly because they're big enough that people are already paying attention.
Yeah.
I still don't think that your obscure artist, indie artist, that, you know, the long tail is still out of our reach.
Mm-hmm.
The long tail we were dreaming of on the internet, where every artist would find its complete audience
mm-hmm.
with a great artistic statement, isn't there. But if you already have the momentum, if you already have the recognition, it's easy to get people to pay attention, or at least to stream your album once and decide, well, you know, it's only got one good song on it.
So this is only an option that's available to the
established,
to the pre-famous,
the 1%.
Yeah.
Wow, you said that.
But on the other hand, it's really encouraging people who are that good, mm-hmm. like Beyonce or like Bon Iver or like Frank Ocean, to do it,
mm-hmm.
to take that chance, to not worry about, you know, I got to have a killer single on this,
mm-hmm.
to really write the song that they want to write, which is encouraging.
I mean, you
were talking earlier about the Spotify aesthetic.
Yeah,
I think we had this great fearful period where every song was going to be written by somebody, by Max Martin or somebody who had worked with him.
Yeah.
And every song you could ever hear on the radio would be from them, and it would all be a really slowly evolving formula. And you're saying the Spotify aesthetic is another.
Yeah. I mean,
another
frankly,
coalescing
it makes
formula.
Me miss Max Martin. To be I don't know if you ever sit through a complete Spotify New Music Friday playlist, you'd be crying for a Max Martin record by the end of it, just for the record. Shouts to Ali, too, like the whole quad.
This is the opposite. This is, we're not trying for that common denominator. We're allowing ourselves quirks.
The streaming ecosystem opens up a lot of possibilities for the album artist, because you know that you're going to be able to hit a fan where they live. They don't have to come and find you. They don't have to come and either buy you. They don't have to come and buy a physical. They don't have to buy the download. You're going to find them, and they're dedicated already. So they actually will sit through. Like, I think in the same way a person will sit through Views, even though Views is not a narratively coherent record, the same way a Drake fan will sit through that, a Frank Ocean fan knows that they will sit through all of Blonde or all of Endless. And Frank Ocean knows that. And that frees a guy like Frank or a guy like Justin Vernon or a person like Beyonce to say, you know what? I'm just going to make a record that is true to me and trust that the way that the medium will allow me to be heard in that way. Whereas previously it might be like, I'm going to make a difficult record and I don't know if people are going to show up and buy it. Now, you know, if someone's going to dive in, they are going to be able to go with you all the way and not have to pay a dime for it. So I feel like in essence, what someone like Vernon or someone like Frank Ocean is saying to the fans is like, don't let me down.
I need ya, I need ya, I need you right now. Yeah, I need you right now. So don't let me, don't let me, don't let me down. I think I'm losing my mind now. It's in my head, darling. I hope that you'll be here when I need you the most. So don't let me, don't let me, don't let me down. Don't let me down. Don't let me down.
Another person saying, don't let me down. Or another group of people saying, don't let me down this year, were the Chainsmokers, the one guy and the other guy. And this song is with Daya, who is a young singer who we've talked about on Pomcast previously. And Don't Let Me Down is one of several big hits of the Chainsmokers this year. And when I think about motivating tensions of 2016, I don't necessarily think about sort of the struggles with EDM or how big it is in the pop universe. But I do think about how we're starting to see a kind of segmenting of audiences where you have your quote-unquote serious artists who are going to deliver album-length statements, and they're siphoning off one kind of fan. And then you have very ruthless chart-attacking groups, Chainsmokers, 21 Pilots, who we will speak of later. But let's talk about the year in singles, especially as juxtaposed against the year in albums. Because apart from a few exceptions, I don't know, maybe like Pablo is kind of an exception, but not really. Beyonce, I guess, is sort of an exception. But apart from a handful, I don't think there were a lot of artists who played successfully in both spaces this year.
Yeah, maybe Rihanna, if you like
yeah.
Anti, arguably. But yeah, when you talk about the Chainsmokers, you're talking about a group that only cares about singles. They, have yet to put out a debut album.
Yeah, it's like the 1950s.
Selfie, their big hit, came out, what,
4 years
ago? Yeah. And yet they just keep releasing these monster smashes that are big on the radio, big on Spotify, big on YouTube. And then it was almost an afterthought for them to say, oh, maybe we should collect five of these and call it an EP.
Yeah, completely superfluous.
You don't even need it because these songs are massive without needing any context. And clearly people don't even care who these guys are. You mostly don't hear them on the song. They're not.
And frankly, the moments where they have sort of stepped out front have not been their most successful. You think about the moment with Halsey at the VMAs where the one dude, I'm sorry, I just keep calling the one dude, but whatever, it's like Taggart and the other guy. But where the one dude sort of like puts his hand very awkwardly around Halsey's stomach, and I'm just like, oh, you were better when you were anonymous, frankly. Like, this is not a wave. You shouldn't do this. Let's talk in the sort of bigger picture. Why did dance music finally arrive this year? Is it merely that the Chainsmokers kind of hit on something, or do you think we're seeing something that's kind of like the logical end product of the last, you know, TK years?
What do you mean finally arrived this year? I mean, we had Lady Gaga, we had dance music arriving,
right?
I mean, it's like the R train, you know, it's just here.
And the EDM bubble, yeah, just kept getting bigger until maybe it didn't even feel like a bubble anymore.
But here's what you're getting at, I think, is that I actually think that the persistence of things like the Chainsmokers is radio really trying desperately to cling to a format. Radio stations wanting something homogenous that has a little for everybody, has a little EDM, has a little depressive, you know, introspective singer, has a little bit of melody, has enough that people don't turn it off. I mean, radio stations are not about excitement. They're about passive acceptance.
Consistent.
Yeah, and the Chainsmokers, it's pleasant enough on enough fronts so that people don't turn it off.
And you had hits this year from Calvin Harris, who quietly had another huge year.
DJ Snake.
Same
thing.
The
Bieber record. In the way that we were talking earlier about a Spotify aesthetic, it's interesting to hear you talk about there being almost a radio aesthetic at play. And I'm not convinced they're that radically different, but is the radio aesthetic just sort of like more like the pumped up version of what we're hearing on in streaming ecosystems?
That's what I would think, because, I mean, it still has to get, still has to be noticeable on your car radio or in your earbuds.
And in a way, like Spotify, Apple Music, like all these online systems are much more refined versions of the kind of like call-out research that radio stations used to rely on very heavily, where this will sound hilarious to any real young person out there, but like radio stations used to have the equivalent of like polling services, and maybe still do, where they would call out and play people 20 seconds of a song and be like, would you listen to the whole song or do you like this record? Now, you don't need to hire a company to do that. You have Spotify's emerging playlist. You can be like, oh, well, clearly 100 million people have listened to this. Maybe we should throw it on the radio. So maybe the radio aesthetic is what you're saying. It is a central locale for all these sort of ideas that used to be in competition, but now have sort of like found a way to coexist.
And though I think Calvin Harris, you know, had already started a dominant streak on radio, I think you can trace a lot of this back to the success of Where Are You Now, which was pretty surprising at the time because it didn't have a traditional chorus. You know, obviously it had the Justin Bieber star power, and it sort of represented, you know, the birth of Skrillex and Diplo as these pop kingmakers, you know, just sort of like, and they could throw any vocalist on a song. Lean On was the follow up as well.
# let Justin sing R&B. Sorry, just had to throw that in there.
But then you've seen throughout 2016, Justin Bieber's career has been sort of floating
saved.
I'm not going to say saved because, you know, he made a successful album on his own, but, you know.
Album of the Year nominee.
There you go. Purpose. But he's essentially an EDM vocalist if you're listening to pop radio these days.
And which is a very strange thing because I think it's exact. I mean, just as a sidebar on Bieber, I think it's exactly the kind of thing he's not that into. And he doesn't. You watch videos of him dancing to these records on stage and it's like.
But you know, he had two songs in the top 10 simultaneously. One DJ Snake, one with Major Lazer. Yep. They weren't anybody's best song, and yet they were in constant rotation.
Let's listen to a bit of DJ Snake and Justin Bieber, Let Me Love You.
Don't you give up, nah, nah, nah. I won't give up, nah, nah, nah. Let me love you. Let me love you. Don't you give up, nah, nah, nah. I won't give up, nah, nah, nah. Let me love you. Let me love you. Oh,
So speaking of Justin Bieber, as we were just saying, Justin Bieber's Purpose is a nominee for Album of the Year at the Grammys, which, depending how you look at it, is either a notation that the Grammys are finally catching up with kind of the center of American pop music, or a complete horrifying misstep when you think about all the albums that were released that were not nominated.
At a certain point, as the people who actually can cast Grammy ballots get older and older, mm-hmm. they're giving their ballots to their teenage grandchildren. And they love Justin.
I like this conspiracy theory.
Wow, that's fire. That's a fire take. We got to report that out.
I'll look into it.
Yeah, I feel like if we got to dig deep onto IG comments and stuff, yeah. we'll find some kid who posted his dad's Grammy ballot. All right. So this is a thing that is happening, but it also is coming at a time that are a little bit fraught for the Grammys. Frank Ocean decided to boycott this year because he felt that he would not be treated with adequate respect. I think also this is a particularly tough year to try to win a big Grammy. You know, Adele, Beyonce, Kanye, there's a lot of people put out
Adele
and also Adele. Are the Grammys molting? Are they trying to get to a better place or not? Even it's interesting. I was thinking a lot about Sturgill. Sturgill is the sort of outsider Album of the Year nominee and also the sort of traditionalist outside nominee. And if he wins, he's going to get a tremendous bump, but also a tremendous backlash.
Right. He's the Beck. He's the Arcade Fire.
Right. And I happen to think he's a good one of those.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that he will be treated kindly if he actually somehow wins that thing.
If Adele and Beyonce somehow split the pop vote and then the guitar vote all goes to Sturgill Simpson.
Yes.
A scenario that could happen.
Absolutely. That's the Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
But
Michigan
I think
thing
one of
happening.
The things you're seeing here, and this has sort of been a specter on both of these year-end conversations we've had, is that it just so happens that the most popular artists happen to put out some pretty great albums this year.
2016 was a tough year. It was a tough year to make a top 10 list, because usually when you're making a year-end list, it's like you actually don't have so many obvious, big, flashing red light candidates.
So I think you're seeing a few things here, which is that, yes, the Grammys have changed, you know, what kinds of people, who younger, more diverse voters, and that's beginning to show itself. But also you just had, as we said, the 1%, the dominant pop musicians, they came correct this year.
Mm-hmm. This goes back with the Grammys, though. And the Grammys, the Grammys are always so torn between artistic excellence and sales.
Yeah.
And they've usually repudiated the total populist. You don't see the Chainsmokers up there for the EP. But
They do have a Best New Artist nomination this year.
There you go.
Can't wait for that acceptance speech.
They're going to be holding the presenter's stomach. Whoever it is, if it's Kanye.
Yeah, and outside of the album category, you do get, you see some that are pleasantly surprising. You see Chance the Rapper, mm-hmm. Best New Artist nomination, which, is exciting to maybe people who don't care about the Grammys traditionally.
And sort of an interesting contrast to the Frank situation. Frank's basically I'm not playing ball. Chance is not only am I playing ball, I'm bringing the ball.
Right. But then you get the weird industry picks that are obviously, that you see a song Lucas Graham 7 Years nominated in Song of the Year, mm-hmm. Record of the Year. You see Mike Posner, I Took a Pill in Ibiza, not even the dance remix, which was the popular version,
right.
But the original acoustic version nominated for Song of the mm-hmm. Year. Those are Grammy picks, and you're I'm not quite sure
it's always a head
where that came from.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the Lucas
that was
Graham.
That was a number one record, though, wasn't it?
The remix.
One. Yes, the remix. Yes, but as a song. If it's the song is a songwriter's, so that's I wouldn't be surprised if technically what was nominated by his label or his people was the original, not the remix.
Sure, but it's just I guess you see, these are still pop records, but they're not necessarily flaunting their trendsetter taste.
No.
These are safe major label.
Yes. To that point, let's just touch back on a thing that Frank said to me about boycotting. He's like, the Grammys do not adequately represent where I come from and people who hold down what I hold down. When I think about some of the most sort of vibrant, vital stuff that's been happening in pop music in the last 12 months, I'm thinking about memes. I'm thinking about dance videos. I'm thinking about stuff like that. And obviously,
the Grammys aren't equipped for those.
No, but someone in the world could be, but the Grammys especially are poorly equipped. Let's talk about Juju on that beat. Let's talk about the Mannequin Challenge. Things like that in many ways are the most quickly moving and vital engine in pop music today. It's almost impossible, not just for an organization like the Grammys to get a hold of, but even for major labels to kind of get a hold of.
Well, do we want the Grammys dipping their toe in?
Because you know they do it 2 years too late.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm not sure we do. But then, all right, so let's have our own Grammys. Like, let's just talk about what about that space is so important. Because to me, it's if you want to know what the epicenter of young black creativity is, it's that. And it's not anywhere represented in the institutions that we're paid to worry about.
Well, I think what's happening is things come and go faster. I mean, the Grammys are annual. At the beginning of this year, the David Bowie album came out centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's a meme lasts.
Yeah,
a meme stays online a couple of weeks. It's gone. Mm-hmm. There's a new one. I mean, there's really no way to tabulate that with something that moves annually or with a record label, a major label that has to have 12 people sign off on a decision.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is wrecking all this stuff.
At the same time, they don't need recognition from the Grammys because it has this sort of, you know, it has the vibrancy of something that's grassroots. You talk about Juju on that beat that, you know, that maybe there's some shadowy marketing behind it. You know, I don't know. I haven't heard it. But what you see is, you know, some kids making up a dance, some other teenagers mm-hmm. here learning that dance, making Instagram videos. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, you get the major label knocking on the door and saying, someone better monetize this while it's hot.
Well, and I think what's interesting is these things are happening in spaces that are not cleanly monetized, which is something that I think enhances the level of creativity that can happen. People who are posting Vines or posting IG videos are not worrying about ad revenue. Now maybe they should be, because they're losing their intellectual property and they're losing their cultural capital. But, like, broadly speaking, monetization has not come in, especially at, like, the root level of creation. And so I think that's why things happen in such a zippy pace, and that's why things happen in a way with that they don't get ultimately big picture acknowledged.
And this takes us a little bit back to the streaming conversation, which is that, you know, these songs, they don't even need radio play to end up in the top 10 on the Billboard charts now because of the way that the streams are counted.
And frankly, it got Black Beatles to the number one song in the country. I mean, not that Black Beatles wasn't doing well independently. It was doing fine, but it got Black Beatles number one. I mean, it got, you know, Juju on that beat, I think, as a top 10,
yeah. 20.
I don't know if that would have happened if Juju on that beat had not been picked up by Warner. By the Warner system. I don't know how easily that would have happened, but it was on the path towards happening anyway. It just took someone that had to come in and kind of like smooth out the paperwork.
And a group like Ray Sherman is most equipped to play ball in this arena because they know how the internet works. They're discovering on the internet as well. They have someone like Mike Will Made It behind them who, you know, was around for Gucci using mixtapes to make himself an important artist, you know, more almost 10 years ago. And mm-hmm. they're sort of students of how trends move online.
I will say this, like one thing that I like about how memes and meme music and memes, generally speaking, have been moving through the ecosystem is who they end up eventually ensnaring in their kind of like unpredictable reach. And I think you saw that with the Mannequin Challenge, where you have a Mannequin Challenge with Hillary Clinton and Bill and Huma, which is pretty hilarious, synced incredibly well. Shout out to whoever did that. But also you have things like the So Gone Challenge, where established artists actually decide to participate. And that ends up creating a nice intersection of the speed of how digital things move, but also acknowledging the power of how someone genuinely famous in the old-fashioned way can shine a spotlight on something like that. So let's go out with Chance the Rapper's version of the So Gone Challenge.
Most romantic moment of the year.
True story.
Thanks for filming this. I wrote this for you today. Channel, a.k.a. Mr. Windy City. Remix! I got the baddest chick on the planet. She ain't mixed, but folks be asking if she half Hispanic. She complained about the baby weight, but I ain't panicked. Since she got pregnant, she been showing crack like bad mechanics.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast, Year in Ideas 2016. Thanks to my guests, John Perales and Joe Coscarelli. You can read everyone's writing about the year in music at nytimes.com/music. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your thoughts, feelings, and ideas and darkest secrets at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll be back next week.
Always keep your phone. Ask my BM. She got her own ringtone, and she was singing.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.